VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome is brought to you by RPGNow.com, the internet's leading source of PDF game products, and listeners like you. Thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
Hey, this is Elminster Shadowdale, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 118. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, Will Wong gets all covered in slimy tentacles and in Abelethic Sovereignty, books 1 and 2. That's right, I took a bit of a break after the DMG2 event. That took a lot of work on my part, and I needed to take a breather afterwards, but I've been sitting on this review for some time. And more so, there's a fun interview with the author and WotC game designer, Bruce Cordell, that goes along with it. The Abelethic Sovereignty is a Forgotten Realms novel trilogy written by Bruce Cordell that focuses on a new part of the realms that came into existence in the 4th edition version of the game, and it has been left to this novel series to explain how that happened. It should be a good example of how 4th edition D&D has impacted the novel lines from Wizards of the Coast. So let's toss it to Will Wong to tell us a bit more, and after that, we'll head over to the interview with Bruce Cordell.
Hey, this is Will Wong with a second attempt at the Tome's reviews of the first two books of The Abelethic Sovereignty, Plague of Spells and City of Torment by Bruce Cordell. The first one was possibly eaten by Windows. I'm not really sure what happened. The file was corrupted or something. So now Jeff gets to edit a whole new file. Hi, Jeff. I hope you have fun with this. I'm going to keep this pretty short and almost entirely free of spoilers. We'll start with the short, short version, as they said in Spaceballs. They're both good books. You should buy them. See, that was the short, short version. Okay, on to the real one. We're going to start with the three main characters that the book follows and a little bit about them. Then we'll see where I go from there. I'm full of caffeine, so I'm not thinking right. First character, the book opens the day before the spell plague with Raiden Kane, the half-elf, half-human. His human ancestry is a Shu. He's a monk. His life's work is to hunt aberrants using the power of the Cerulean Sign, which in the interview with Bruce he said appeared in one of his other books. So listen to the interview and then go find that book too. His adopted daughter, whose name I cannot remember. She dies in the opening hours of the spell plague, like their house collapses on her or something, and he cannot forgive himself for not being there when she needed him. He has nightmares about her dying, calling out for him, that sort of thing. It really is what drives his personality throughout the two books. The second character is Anusha. I've confirmed with Bruce that is how you pronounce that. I'm pronouncing that one right. It is Anusha. She's a young human girl. She's a noble of some sort. She's 20, but she was sheltered pretty much her whole life. So in the beginning, she seems much younger, but she matures fairly rapidly. Her half-brother is not apparently of noble lineage. So he's trying to use his relation to her to legitimize his claim to some sort of nobility, so that he can get on the new ruling council of the city after the spell plague. She one day discovers that she has this power to leave her body, sort of like an astral projection, but only when she's asleep. She can't just do it. She can't just jump out of her body and suddenly fight things as a mental projection. That's important to the story, especially towards in the next one, or the second book. It's not really explained why or how it works, how she got this power, why she can do it. She has this dream about blue fire. Blue fire represents anything to do with the spell plague. So it may be part of the spell plague. Bruce never comes right out and says it in the books, so I don't know. I'm willing to write it up to the spell plague. She finds out that her half-brother is using her, and he really doesn't like her. So she alters some records, gets in this large trunk. It's referred to as a travel chest. Grabs a bunch of food, supplies, hides in there, has it put on a ship with the next character, so she can get away from her half-brother, who is being a jerk. She's sick of him controlling her life, and she wants to strike out on her own, and you know that all that sort of thing. The third character that I mentioned is Japheth. That is how it's pronounced. I had been mentally mispronouncing it the entire time. He is a human warlock. He has the Fae Pact. He's addicted to a drug with 100% lethality. It's called Traveler's Dust. Turns your eyes red. You get kind of high, and you can see magic more clearly. So it's a drug that also gives you detect magic to a degree. His pact was made in desperation. He was about to die from the drug, and he basically cried out, you know, I'll give anything if somebody saves me. And this archfey called the Lord of Bats, whose actual name is pronounced something like Neafon. There's a pronunciation guide in the back of each book. I don't know why it's in the back. It doesn't help me in the back. I finish the book. I'm pronouncing things a certain way, and then this is the correct way to pronounce them in the back. I would have put it in the front. Every other book I've seen that has that, in the front. Okay, Japheth has... The pact with the Lord of Bats stops him from progressing further into the assured death that the Traveler's Dust will bring him. That's part of the pact. He manages to steal the Lord of Bats' power, essentially. Not all of it, but a decent-sized chunk of it. So he's super warlock. And the Lord of Bats desperately wants... Well, he wants his power back. And he wants to, I believe it was, eat Japheth's liver. Probably while he watches in some act of revenge. It is further complicated by the pact is it is embodied by a jewel, I want to say an emerald, called his pact stone. It is enchanted so that whenever the pact stone is broken, the pact breaks, and the Lord of Bats will be more or less transported, not like instantly teleported, but he will fly through time and space and, you know, dimensions and things, to Japheth, where he will horribly devour him. So the original plan was to hold this over him and basically, you will do my bidding, or I will, if I ever find out you have crossed me, I will break the stone, and I will just appear behind you and eat you. But he steals the pack stone and most of the Lord of Bat's power, and eventually Anusha's half-brother finds out about the stone and steals it from him. I'm guessing while he's asleep or something, I don't think it actually says. And so that's why Japheth starts off working for Anusha's half-brother. So that is the brief overview of the three main characters. There are other characters. The book begins the day before the spell plague with Raiden Kane. He's coming back from a successful aberrant hunt. He's brought a gift for his adopted daughter. He's on the road. The spell plague hits. There's blue fire, random crazy magical effects. He's essentially frozen in amber, trapped in some sort of magical crystal. So he spends 10 years in stasis. So he busts out. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know how long he's been in stasis. He tries to figure out where he is, so he heads to the nearest city, which was destroyed. He fights some things. They tell him they try to eat him. He spends an undetermined amount of time trying to get back to his adopted daughter. Yeah, he eventually makes it there. She's dead. She died in the beginning of the spell plague. There's an angry mob. He sort of gets into a fight with them. The Golem Cynosure teleports him away so that he doesn't start randomly killing these people, because he's essentially mad with grief and outrage that this angry mob is here to throw him out while he's trying to mourn his daughter. The Golem explains to him through his connection. Okay, I missed a step. The Cerulean Sign was this medallion. The spell plague fuses it into him as a spell scar. So he can detect and turn a set, like turn undead, aberrations, one of those. And it connects him to the Golem. I'm not sure how, but it does. So the Golem can mentally communicate with him through the sign. So the Golem, and teleport him great distances, but it takes up a lot of the Golem's energy. So it teleports him away, tells him, you have to do this or the world will be destroyed. there's some internal conflict. He doesn't really care if the world is destroyed because he's a failure as a human being. The only thing he loved is gone, and so on. The golem convinces him, of course, to go save the world. Then it cuts over to Japheth and Anusha, where Anusha first exercises her power. She thinks it's all a dream, so she's inadvertently spying on her half-brother and Japheth. Eventually, she realizes with concentration she can manipulate things while she is in her dream form. Her reflection can be seen as sort of indistinct blue outline, which only comes up in the first book, but doesn't happen at all in the second book. I guess there aren't a lot of reflective surfaces where they are. Japheth can see her with the Traveler's Dust, or later on certain spells. There's a wizard that comes up later, but she has spells that allow her to see Anusha. The half brother wants Japheth to keep an eye on some business dealings of his because he occasionally hires these pirates led by Captain Foster, who has a crazy sword. It is referred to as a golemwork sword. The sword constantly bleeds poison on itself, which is pretty cool. He has some sort of impure blood. He has a link to the Katoa, but in the first two books, that is not explained fully. It's mentioned in the first book. It's a bigger part of the second book. Third book is not out yet, of course. So we don't know. We don't know how that goes. He's there. Japheth goes on the boat, and Anusha gets her trunk with her in it put on the boat. So everything is okay for a couple of days. Anusha explores the ship as her dream state. Eventually, she gets spotted. She almost kills somebody. This is the first time she touches somebody. She almost kills somebody by putting her hand through them, interfering with their organs, I guess blood flow. It is not specified, but someone next to him screams, "A ghost is killing whatever," and everyone comes down to look. The wizard hits her with something that dispels ghosts or banishes them or whatever, and she goes back to her body in the chest. But Japheth has taken his traveler's dust, so he sees her form go back into the chest and has it brought into his room, and he opens it up, and hey, there's a little girl in it. What's going on? Eventually, she wakes up, and she tells him this whole thing, the whole story, and then this kind of Katoa shows up, and she tells everybody about the Dream Heart, the evil artifact of great power that is approximately half the first book in a nutshell. So I don't know how much of that Jeff wants to leave in or not. Jeff, let me know. No, don't let me know. Just edit. The review of the book itself, I enjoyed pretty much all of it. Throughout the book, there is a degree of growth with Anusha. She has the most growing to do, so it's immediately apparent with her. She was this sheltered child that you could almost think of as like 12, let's say. But by the end of the book, she's more confident in herself and her abilities and so on, and she seems like a real person. You know, she's an actual grown-up. Japheth develops feelings for her, which play a big part in the second book. My first read through the book, I sort of got to the end and I'm going, this is kind of out of the blue, but it's not. If you look, there's signs almost from the beginning. As soon as he finds her in the chest, the signs begin that he has feelings for her. Raiden Kane grows a lot in the second book. He has a nervous breakdown. It's great. He is the first monk ever to go into a barbarian-style rage and be possessed by a sentient weapon at the same time. It's kind of neat. There's plenty of character growth. The characters, they feel very three-dimensional. The actual writing of the book, it was very well-paced, and the story was interesting, even with the minutiae and the almost filler that you have to put in to get a book up to X many pages. I read it, and I frequently did not want to put it down. Even on my second read through the first book, I think it only took me like 4 days to read it. That is how well it was written. Just a quick aside on fight scenes. Anusha fights in her dream form. It's kind of neat, but the fights are not terribly wordy, which is good because nothing drives me crazy quite like a fight that takes 30 seconds of actual time, but is 10 pages. That drives me frickin' crazy. There is a reasonable amount of detail in spells. Japheth's warlock spells get a little bit more detail, I think because Bruce likes warlocks, and the warlocks have some crazy effects, like the spectral mouths devour people, that sort of thing. They have weird effects that it's cool to describe, really. One of the things he does is he opens up his cloak, which is the symbol of the Lord of Bat's power that he stole. It's connected to him. It's like his second skin. I don't know exactly what that means. But he opens up the cloak and bats come out of it and they attack. And that's a common attack of his. So that gets some description. Any combat to do with Raiden is based on Bruce's own knowledge of martial arts. And then, I guess, brought up in degree. Not like too crazy anime levels, but human plus, like Captain America degree. He can jump 20 feet. When he punches somebody, he never breaks a bone. He never accidentally breaks his knuckle. I guess training would do that too, but, he elbows somebody in the head and is not injured. I don't know how normal that is. But the fight scenes were good and interesting. They were important. They were short and to the point. And in fact, one of the most impressive fight scenes in the second book, there's almost no detail. It's just Raiden is going nuts, and then and Japheth is doing this, and Anusha is doing that. It doesn't zoom in on any of them, and something that could bog down the book for 35 pages doesn't. Both of the books follow more or less the same structure, where everybody is more or less completely separate, and they slowly are drawn together as the book progresses, and then two-thirds, three-quarters of the way through the book, they meet up in some horrible dungeon-y, D&D-style dungeon that you would never, ever want to go to, or anyone in their right mind would want to go to. And then there's a fight. Raiden gets mad at Japheth. That's pretty common. Raiden's an angry guy at this point. And then there's a twist on the very last page. That's how they go. All right, so the first book takes a while to get going. It's introducing characters. You don't really know exactly what's going on. The second book, almost right into it from the beginning. It isn't much of a standalone book. If you were to attempt to read the second book without having any knowledge of the first book, you'd sit there and go, what is going on, for like 80 pages until you pieced it together. I'm waiting with bated breath for the third book. I can't wait to see how it ends. In fact, from what I learned in the interview, Bruce can't wait to see how it ends. That was the not-quite-so-short review of the first two books of The Abolithic Sovereignty, attempt number two. If this doesn't work, I'm just going to use the short version of the whole review.
Now I want to take a quick break to talk about our sponsor for the episode, RPGNow.com. My pick for this episode, to let you know the sort of things you can get at RPGNow.com, is a product from Precise Intermedia, from their Disposable Heroes line of paper miniatures. I've been using their Disposable Heroes line of paper miniatures for some time now, and have thoroughly enjoyed them. I specifically want to tell you about the Fantasy Set 6 Monsters line, which I recently received a review copy of. This set is all monsters, but it isn't just monsters, it's large monsters. I reviewed some of their material a while back, and one of my concerns was that there wasn't any support for monsters larger than the medium size. Well, now you have some of that covered. We have a couple of dragons, a gelatinous cube, a hydra, a troll, a treant, and more. There's 30 monsters in all here, which is not as many as it seems, honestly, but it's very easy to substitute in these creatures for many others, so that you can easily spend less than $5 for this product and have a much more enriching gaming experience without having to spend the big money on normal minis in order to create a whole dungeon or army full of monsters. And it's available on RPGNow.com. Check it out and find links in the show notes.
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Palladium Books and White Wolf Publishing. There are new products every single day. Come to RPGNow.com and get them the instant they're available.
And now I am once again joined by Will Wong, an author and game designer, Bruce Cordell. Let's not wait any longer. Here we go.
All right. This is Will. I'm here with Jeff in the background. Say hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
That joke never gets old. And Bruce Cordell is here.
Hi, this is Bruce. Thanks for having me.
And we're going to talk about his his new book and the previous book since we got him here, The Plague of Spells and City of Torment.
Sounds good to me.
Yes. I'm excited. Jeff?
Woohoo!
So we've talked about pronunciations before the interview started. So I'm at least close on all of these. How did you write these? Are they all... Did you just start out, for example, with that outline of it's just going to start like this, and then the ending is going to be like this, and everything in the middle is, you know, it's vague points that you want to hit on, or do you go book by book, or what?
So when I sat down to... When I knew I was going to write the trilogy, The only thing that was really due was the outline for the first book, but I knew that I had to come up with some sort of, you know, I had to come up with the arc outline as well in order for the, you know, first book to go anywhere. So I spent a good amount of time kind of coming up with what the overall arc would be, and I knew that the second book, something interesting had to happen in the second book, or it would be, or the series would flop. So I came up with the arc first, and then started writing. After I came up with the overall arc, then I sat down and wrote the outline for the first book. And then when I finished the first book, I wrote the outline for the second book. But you know, in each case, I used the arc as the initial idea of what I had for what was going to happen in all three books as the basis for each specific book's outline. Same for the third book, which I'm writing right now.
Okay, so like a almost a story bible, that sort of idea.
Yeah, in the case of the arc, it was a very light story bible. It was a picture. I just drew various elements that I knew I wanted in the book and stared at it for a while until everything kind of gelled and how I wanted them to connect.
So the basis between approximately 1,000 pages of writing is a half elf punching a blob.
I suppose so, something like that. I have a picture of Zifu, the eldest, squatting on top of that. I have a picture of the dream heart, and I have a picture of something called the Key of Stars and the Citadel of the Outer Void. So that's kind of like, that's where I started, and that's from that I came up with the arc for the three book series.
Okay. All right. I'm checking off a question here.
Is there anywhere we can go to see those pictures?
Not at this point. They're actually sitting here on my bulletin board in my office.
Well, if you ever wanted to scan them and have them up on the Tome Show's website, we'd be happy to host that for you.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll get a third party's opinion whether they think this picture is of quality enough for me to think that's a good idea or not. It may be that it should remain here on my bulletin board.
Maybe.
It's I would say it's not of the quality of, like, say, you know, Tolkien's pictures for instance, so I don't know if I really want it to get out into the world. Better in your imagination than in reality, probably.
Who would you say is the main character in this book, or does it not have one?
When you're talking City of Torment,
really throughout the trilogy, let's say, because it does jump between three different characters.
Yeah, I think that people have a tendency to want to see Raiden Kane be the main character, and he certainly takes up a lot of space, but Japheth and Anusha also really, you know, kind of start taking up a lot of space as well. So even though the story, you know, Raiden Kane could be said to be the main character, I would say that he certainly kind of steps somewhat to the side, at least in the City of Torment, to kind of follow, to some extent, what happens to Japheth and Anusha, and what happens to them at the end of the first book, in fact, you know, drives a lot of the tension that comes to the fore in City of Torment, and in fact sets the stage for City of Torment.
Yeah, you pretty much got half a book out of the end of the first one.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I didn't really know how the first one was going to end until the final day of writing the outline of the first book. No, not even the outline, the first draft. I was like, "Oh, what? Oh my god, this is what happens." It was perfect. So, it really I was so glad that idea came to me.
Did it just come to you in a dream? Was there strange alien music playing?
Yeah, that was probably. No, I was sitting in front of my computer, just you know, as each event unfolded, and it occurred to me, wait a second, I know what's going to happen now. And then I laughed, you know, deep and evilly.
I'm sure you're a fun DM.
Yeah, my players. Yes, my players think so. Especially when each one of them most recently got caught in a gelatinous cube, and I got to put them inside the little gelatinous cube miniature, and I laughed each time they didn't think it was quite so funny.
That's a really cool miniature, though.
Yeah, I know. It's half the fun is using the miniature and sticking other miniatures inside of it.
All right. Well, I think I sort of lean towards Raiden Kane as the main character in the first book, if only because he's the first character you see.
Yep.
Do you think that
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Do you think that him being the first character that you see sort of prejudices you towards focusing on him as the main character when it goes to Inusha and to Japheth? You think, oh, it's these side characters until the second book when he's pushed aside.
Yeah, I think a lot of people probably will think that Raiden is the main character, and even though Inusha and Japheth have an interesting interplay, and Japheth, you know, they both have interesting conflicts with their way they access their power, so to speak. Raiden is the main character in that sense, and you'll see probably in Kia Stars he comes back more to the fore because, you know, he definitely has the tools to deal with the situation, at least more so than the other characters.
Okay.
Despite some of his difficulties towards the end of City of Torment.
It's okay. In my review I referred to it as his nervous breakdown.
Okay.
Which character do you like writing the most?
I was going to get to that.
Oh, okay.
But it's cool.
It just occurred to me.
It's your show.
You know, I like writing different ones at different times. It's Raiden can be hard to write sometimes because he's such an austere character. But then when he kind of had his nervous breakdown, you could kind of see, well, okay, even the best of us with the most discipline and focus can, you know, maybe, you know, have a little fall from that grace. And that was very interesting to write. But each character, as I'm writing them, I really get into the character quite a bit, and I enjoy that character while I'm writing him or her, and then I move on. Oh, okay, now I'm back to this character. So I don't think there's one in particular that I like the most.
Let's phrase it in a way that you can't cop out then.
Oh. You tell him, Jeff.
That's right. So if you were going to be the next Bob Salvatore, which one of these characters would you want to be stuck with as your Drizzt?
Writing 300 books about.
Right.
Oh, that's a very interesting way of putting that.
Yeah.
Well, let's just say Raiden then.
Okay.
Oh, I would think it would be Japheth. That way you could squeeze Inusha in there.
Yeah. No, it's very close. You could tell that I definitely enjoyed writing Japheth. I do like him a lot as well. Yeah.
All right. Are these your first novels?
No,
or did
actually,
you do others?
I've written a few others. My first one actually never saw the light of day because of something that happened between Hasbro and some other partner. But the first one I was able to actually get published without my name was one of the T.H. Lane books. They're dungeon adventures, and it was The Oath of Nerul. And the first one I got published under my own name was Lady of Poison. And so there was Lady of Poison, then Dark Vision, then Stardeep, and then the beginning of this trilogy, Plague of Spells and City of Torment.
Do you think you've I suppose, I don't know, refined your process, technique?
Yes.
As an author, as you've gone on?
Oh, yeah. I definitely learn something about writing every time I write a book, and I like to get the feedback of, you know, editors and other people and learn more about writing, you know, fiction, writing prose, because it is so really different than game writing. It really requires a different, in my opinion, way of just formatting it. Not formatting your brain, but you really have to keep in mind what you're doing. So you're showing, not telling. And in the game, you're often telling, not showing, even though, you know, in some cases that's not appropriate, but it's kind of a tradition. So, yeah, I'm definitely always trying to learn. And if I go back and read text from, you know, especially, well, I don't, yeah, like those first two, ugh, I don't even like to read. I don't even like to
you
even
You just sort of cringe.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I just want to redo them. I just want to...
pretend they didn't happen.
Yeah.
Now, is it the same way with the gaming supplements?
To some extent.
You look
extent.
Back and you don't like them, or
I do find that I went on quite a bit with some of those early game supplements. It's like, wow, I could have probably boiled that down, that thought down to you know, a quarter of that sometimes, but it just it's, you know, it seemed to work for the era, you know, for second edition when I first started writing. Seem to do the job. I mean, I find that I don't find it cringeworthy, though. It fits its day. It fits its age. It fits its the style that everyone else was writing in.
And you can just tell anybody who had a problem with it that you were running on because you were paid by the word.
Yeah, I guess so.
Whether it's true or not, people will believe.
It's a great
it.
Tradition. Yes, yes. Whether true or not.
All right. I got a couple of questions we can branch off from here with. You're sort of Wizard's unofficial aberrant guy. How does that work out for you?
Well, it's interesting to have that reputation even inside Wizards. People, if they see a tentacle pop up in a book, like, oh, did Bruce have something to do with this book? And I'm like, no. A lot of people like Cthulhoid stuff, and just because I, you know, kind of brought it into the game way back when doesn't mean that I'm responsible for every tentacle that appears in the game. So that said, it's kind of both very cool and kind of like a stereotype, which is hard to walk away from. But yet here I am writing a trilogy about creatures that are certainly Lovecraft inspired. So there you go. I can't really claim that it's not appropriate.
You were on Lords of Madness, right?
I wrote a lot of the material that Lords of Madness included, such as the Alithiad. So if you see some text like on Alithids in the Alithiad, in Lords of Madness, it probably came from the Alithiad. But I actually didn't work on Lords of Madness.
Oh, okay. I thought you did.
Many people have come up to me and said, oh, I really like Lords of Madness.
Liked it too, but
there's that reputation.
Yeah. Well, I don't usually look at the people who write my gaming supplements. I just try to look away from the price.
Ah, gotcha.
All right. How is it different to writing a novel versus writing a game supplement? And do you prefer one over the other?
Writing a novel is different. In the modern day of writing games, at least at Wizards, it's very much a collective effort. You even writing on the design side, you meet with a lot of people to refine your ideas, and there's a lot of contributors to a project. Then it goes to a development team, and they have their time with the material. And then it goes to editing, and it's a very much of an effort that everyone takes part in. And for the, I'm really kind of excited to see that at Wizards, the current teams we have, that all is working really well, and, you know, great stuff is coming of it. When you're writing a novel, though, it's pretty much, you writing, and you come up with the idea and you develop it to its full extent, and of course you talk to your editor as much as possible to bounce ideas off if you can, and it will go to the editor and the editor will tell you, you know, what will be required in the second draft, but you're the writer of the second draft as well. It doesn't go off to a development team to write it. You take it on again, and what comes out is what you produce. So in that sense, there's a big difference between writing game product and writing novels. And of course, you know, the way you write, the way stories come together, it's very much character driven. You know, you come up with the character when you're writing the novel, and when you're writing the game, you always leave who the character is blank, because those are the players, right? The players are the characters. So it's all plot and hardly any characterization, whereas a novel, it's mostly character with plot, you know, wrapped around it.
Okay. Since we're on character and plot, there's a lot of character growth in the second book, but not very much in the first book. Is that intentional, or did it just not seem like the right time?
The first book, I think, set up the ability for there to be character growth in the second. You just kind of got to know the characters in the first book more, and then the second book was kind of the place for that, some of that to, you know, some of the stuff to come to fruition that had been set up in the first. So, yeah. And maybe we'll see even more in the third.
I hope we get to see more action from the Berserk Monk. That'll be fun.
Yep. Raiden Kane is, we'll get to see his, him have his day, I guess, so to speak. He plays, you know, a very pivotal role in the third book. They all play some, you know, important role, but Raiden will play a very significant role.
He gets to sacrifice himself to save the world, I'm guessing.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if that will happen or not, but he certainly will give it his all.
All right.
Don't want to give away what will happen, but
you don't even know what's going to happen.
I have a lot of words left to write. Exactly.
You'll get to the end and find out that all along it was really happening in Dark Sun.
Yeah. That's right. And then they open a rift to the world of Dark Sun, Aethys. Probably not, actually.
Okay. What is the inspiration for the Dream Heart? We'll go in a completely random direction here. We find out what it is in the second book, but where did the idea come from?
I think that it just kind of developed over time. I knew that I wanted this artifact to be dug up and to have some link to this petrified city of Aboleths. And, you know, once it was disturbed, I knew there was going to be some linkage to the city of Xifu. And the more the Dream Heart was, you know, messed with, the more that was going to, you know, cause problems and start rousing the city. I didn't really know what it really was, though, right away. It just occurred to me, what would be the perfect thing to have happen? Would be for the eye for it suddenly to be revealed as, you know, an eye plucked forth from the eldest and suddenly, you know, open up and stare out at the world. That was like, oh, that would be awesome if that happened. So, oh, okay, this is what this is. So it just kind of developed over time as I was working on the outline and then writing that would be what it would become. I didn't know exactly what it was going to be. I didn't know what its nature was when I started writing about it.
We all know the PHB 3 is not out yet. Uh-huh. Although you probably know much more about it than either Jeff or myself, I hope.
Yeah, I helped work on it.
Okay. Oh, so it's done?
Parts of it.
Okay.
Parts that you certainly some parts that you've seen released on DDI, like the Scion and the Monk.
Cool. That's what I was going to talk about, is the Monk. Raiden Kane, he's a monk from Shu. I don't know where Shu is. I know essentially not. All I know about Forgotten Realms is it's big. It's got Elminster and Driz, and Thay is bad. That's about the extent of my knowledge. Thay is bad.
That's right. Thay is bad. The Aboleth. the Aboleth's sovereignty is bad.
And this is the first I hear of it.
Yes. Well, it's new into 4th edition, so.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you guys, somebody, I don't know if you were part of the team doing the monk class. Were you?
I worked tangentially, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So, like, you ate lunch with a guy who worked on it, and he bounced ideas off of you. Something along those lines.
We had concept meetings where we talked about how the monk would work and how it would work game mechanically, as compared to some of the other classes in the PHB3. But I wasn't the one who sat down and then wrote the monk, power by power, so to speak.
Okay, so you were in the room.
Yes.
Okay. But you weren't at the desk.
I didn't go back to the desk with the ideas in hand and say, let's turn these ideas into, text. Yeah.
Okay.
For the monk.
All right. Did the monk come before Raiden King?
That would be Mike Merles who did that.
Who?
I think that was Mike Merles.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't want, Mike Merles to not get his credit if you're trying to give him credit.
That's right.
So the character of Raiden, he is a monk. He does monk things. I use kung fu as a verb in my review.
Okay.
He kung fu's things. Was he before or after the current concept of the monk? And did sort of the way you wrote him change as the monk was more solidified?
Well, the way the monk and any of the characters really in the book, they're certainly informed by character classes of similar nature, especially the warlock, but they're not necessarily tied directly to. And in case of Raiden, he's pretty much tied to my own specific martial arts background. I train mixed martial arts. One of the reasons I train that is so I know how a monk would fight, for instance, in hand-to-hand and, grappling, jiu-jitsu, that kind of stuff. So that's pretty much what he's based on. I mean, he's based on the tradition of, I did know where the monk was probably going to go, but, even in previous editions of the monk, in D&D, they're very much they can draw on their ki and their mental power to, heal themselves or, gain greater strength. So he's kind of a conglomeration of various concepts of what a monk would be like. So he does precede. So the shorter answer to your question is that, yes, he precedes the monk that will be out in PHB 3, or that's already been released, I believe, on DDI.
So he's an addition neutral monk.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, the many of the characters, are informed by what a D&D side of the game side of things could do, but they're not, they're not specifically bound by that, I should say. Sure. They could say, oh, this guy is of this level range, and he would have that power, generally speaking. But
Well, that's interesting, because we talked to Rich Baker, who wrote Sword Mage, before Sword Mage had come out, and he mentioned how in the second book he's going to have to include a lot more magic. Because in the first book there was very little magic going on with his Sword Mage character.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's good to draw inspiration as much as you can, wherever you can, and the character class specifically is, probably one of your best places to draw it from. But I think it also is good if you can bring, if appropriate, to the character, to draw other things in as well.
Okay, you've taken up another question I was going to ask. I know you do martial arts because you. Hey, did you get your purple belt, or is the result
yes.
not in? You did. Good for you.
Presumably, I got it. I don't think that I didn't do anything poorly, but I guess there's a possibility I didn't get it. But I think at this point it's pretty safe to assume I got it. But he hasn't awarded belts yet.
Okay. So.
But I tested for purple.
All right. So your own knowledge of martial arts did that we've discussed that it helped you write the character of Raiden and what he's capable of. How did Did that help you with any of his fight scenes? I noticed that those are the most detailed fight scenes in involving him.
Yeah, because I mean, certainly he can go far beyond, you know, the ability of any regular martial artist to do things. But the foundation of the things that he does is, you know, I'm thinking of like, okay, what is he doing some sort of wrist compression here? Is he, you know, bending the arm in a certain way so the body is going to follow, fly through the air, some kind of throw, you know, a goshi or ippon sainagi, whatever. It's, you know, something. I'm always thinking what the foundation is, and then it's like, well, okay, now add on to the fact that he's, you know, a 15th level character, so to speak, and now what happens on top of that? So the real world martial art knowledge is the foundation, but then you add on the fantasy element on top of that to bring it to its full potential.
Why did you choose this particular time period? The book is for listeners, the book is I believe it's 10 years after the spell plague starts, so it's 90 years before the book setting, the campaign guide.
The publisher came to me and said, I would be good if you could write the story of the Abilethic sovereignty. We see what it looks like in the current age, but why is it here? Where did it come from? I think there's a story there. And I said, of course, there is a story there. And in order to tell that story, I had to go back and start like right before the spell. Well, and I wanted to use Raiden. So I actually had to start. The first book, Plague of Spells, begins actually right before the spell plague, like the day before. And we kind of see, we follow Raiden through the event and then, you know, what happens to him directly after that. And then finally, you know, the main part of the story then, yeah, begins 10 years after the spell plague. So it's still pretty early on after the tumult that changed the face of Faerûn, and things aren't really settled yet. But that's kind of how that started. Yeah, so it is tracing things through as opposed to jumping the forward jumped by 100 years that many other people made. It seemed to make sense to in order to tell the story properly, it had to occur over through the transition, or at least partway through the transition.
So how much setting lore did you have to, you know, stick to the Forgotten Realms setting, you know, and how much of it did you get to sort of make up on your own? Because I mean, how, you know, especially with the Abilethic sovereignty and this new city and all that kind of stuff, how much of that had been established and how much of that was all you?
It's pretty much all me. The Abilethic sovereignty was completely new to the fourth edition game setting, and the only information that there is about it was in the fourth edition campaign setting. And you know, to be honest, I wrote that material that appeared in the fourth edition campaign setting. So it pretty much was all me. And I didn't know really what the background was going to be until the publisher asked me to say, what's the deal with this city? Tell us more. That gave me the opportunity then to tell the story in the trilogy.
So does that mean the novels are canon? Or has Wizards specifically said no novels are going to be canon?
No, Wizards has not said that. The things that happen in the novels and the things that happen in the game and actually the things that happen in LFR are all considered to be part of, you know, the timeline. Everything that happened earlier, you know, still exists, and these novels are also part of the timeline.
That's part of why the realms are so big, is because everything's canon, whereas in Eberron they've said, you know, the novels and things are not canon, so it doesn't grow the setting to that degree.
That's true. That's true. It makes the job a lot harder to keep on top of everything. We have a continuity meeting. I sit on I wear many different hats, obviously, and one of the things I do is sit on the continuity team and go over all the novels that are coming out, the game product such as exists, which I guess are DDI articles, and we go over. I may be going into too much game material related stuff here, but we'll just say that it is an undertaking that that it does require some time, but we feel that we're up to the challenge, and we've been very happy with how we've been able to handle it.
Well, and that's part of the appeal of the Forgotten Realms for people anyway, I think, is that the setting is so large and vibrant, and, you know, it's alive in all these different places.
Yeah, it's cool. I'm so excited to see that the Living Forgotten Realms be so successful and continue to be so much enjoyed by people at conventions and other places where they play it. So,
the Golem, I cannot pronounce the Golem's name. Is it Cynosure?
Cynosure.
I was pretty close.
Yeah.
And the intelligent homicidal maniac sword, is it Angle?
Angle.
Angle.
I pronounce it Angle, yeah. Or okay. Angle.
Do they only exist in these books, or are they in the campaign guide somewhere? Or in a previous novel that somebody wrote?
They're in a previous novel called Stardeep, which I wrote.
Okay. So those are still yours.
Yes, so they came into being in Stardeep, and I don't know if they appeared in any game product. There's been a couple like articles. I don't think that they've appeared as written up in any statted up in any third or fourth edition. So I think they exist solely in novels, but you know they could certainly exist in a game supplement in the future. Probably not at this point. Cynosure and, well, no, Angle is still part of the situation. You
he's
never
still
know,
running
I guess.
Around.
Who?
I said he's still running around.
Yeah, that's true.
As much as he can.
Yep.
You know, since you bring up Angle appearing in a game supplement, what were your thoughts on the short adventure based off City of Torment that came up 4 or 5 days ago on DDI?
The City of Aboleths?
Yes, I think that's what it's called.
Yeah. Oh, I liked it.
Okay.
And what do you mean? It served a couple different purposes. For me, it served the purpose of being a promotion for City of Torment. And for the game, for Dungeon, it served the need of people who would like to maybe have a little adventure that deals with Aboleths. And it provided like 4 new varieties of Aboleths, at least 4 different varieties of Aboleths for Dungeon Masters who just want to say, hey, I want some new Aboleths to throw in my game. So it provided a lot of different good stuff for different people who might be interested in it, including people who might want to read City of Torment.
And everybody should. Everybody who's even vaguely interested should go do that.
Thanks.
If possible, they should order it through the Tome Show's Amazon link so Jeff can have a dime or however much he gets for bandwidth.
There you go.
That way everyone but me wins. The sword Angle, why did you write him that way? Is he based off of a character, for example, or?
No, the concept was that, you know, as opposed to just, you know, I wanted a sword with a personality that was kind of over the top, but it just seemed like an interesting twist that he was over the top, not because he was evil, but because he was just so, you know, he was kind of a sliver of a real personality, and that sliver of personality was like justice, right? Without any other consideration for any other ameliorating causes or other personality fragments that you'd have in a normal person, because that was forged into the sword, I just wanted to see, you know, where would that go? If that was really the case, how would that sword act? And of course, it turns out it would act like his awful, you know, over-controlling force in whoever's life who wielded it, causing them to do terrible things in the name of, you know, justice no matter what. You know, no shades of gray.
So he's every badly run paladin.
I guess so. He's every badly run paladin. That's like a good way of saying it, I guess. In real life, maybe we will do this because it is right, regardless of the consequences, because we say it is right. Therefore, That's all that matters. Being right is all that matters. Kind of want to see how that plays out. And Angle is a perfect opportunity for to see that that doesn't really play out very well.
Cool. He's an interesting character. Is more going to happen in the third book with him? Or does... I don't know if he'll have a chance to grow at all. He's a weapon.
Yeah, that's the problem with Angle. You see some fragments of what his personality was like. I think, and actually in the first book, just before
it's the first book.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the very fact that he is what he is this frozen personality fragment means he's pretty much just stuck that way, which is kind of sad. But that being said, who knows? I mean. There's always a possibility for some sort of redemption, right? Even for a weapon personality fragment frozen
in
a weapon.
You're right in the book. He could be freed and he could get all blue and walk off with Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
There might be some licensing issues if he walks off with Obi-Wan.
It's a Asian-y enough name. It could be some other guy from Shu.
Yeah, he would have to walk off with you probably haven't read Star Deep, so he would have to walk off with a character in Star Deep.
All right. Why did you name the second book City of Torment? The first book is pretty obvious, Plague of Spells. It opens up with the spell plague. Mm-hmm. That's a big central one. But why specifically City of Torment?
Basically because Zaifu was where people ended up, and especially for Anusha, it's pretty much a city of torment for her and everyone else who's forced to have to go there. That's basically it. It's just basically, city of Zaifu is the city of torment. It's pretty straightforward in that sense. I originally had, when I was first writing the trilogy, and I came up with the arc, I had three, I don't even know what the titles were now, three crappy titles. And I wasn't really very happy with them, but we were kind of moving forward. And one day I was sitting outside on my patio. My wife and I were just, having some wine and talking. And I don't know, it just suddenly came to me, wait a second. I need titles like Plague of Spells, City of Torment, Key of Stars. And then suddenly those became the titles, and I went to my editor, and she said, "Sure, do it." And I'm much happier with what I have now than whatever crappy names I originally had. I don't even remember what they were now.
and these format nicely on the book cover.
Yeah.
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 One word on top of and one word below the big picture.
Yeah, for a lot of reasons. I was happy that just kind of, popped into my head. It just, obviously my subconscious must have been working on it, because it just, bump, bump, bum, 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 bum. They just all kind of follow the same format. They all kind of punch out the main idea, one of the main ideas in each of the books, so.
So what is the Key of Stars that we're going to be seeing in the third book? Is that...
It's unrevealed actually at this point. I know what it is, but that's not. No one really knows what the Key of Stars is when the Key of Stars opens up.
Oh, okay. I was just thinking, is it like a building, or is it more literally a key?
That's unclear.
No little hints or spoilers for us.
You can change it later.
It's true.
It's a little girl.
It would be.
Yeah, there's been too many little girls already, so it's probably not a little girl.
Oh, okay.
It's just been the one. It could be the dog. The dog.
Well, there's a little girl in memory of his daughter, and then there's the little girl in the end of City of Torment, which kind of precipitates the mental breakdown.
Yeah, I thought
so. Maybe there should be a little girl in the third one. Yeah, maybe you're right.
I thought that was good writing, the whole nervous breakdown thing.
Oh, thank you.
All of the character growth. I'm always happy to see character growth in novels.
Yeah, it's a big. I agree. Me too. I like that as well, and my editor is also very concerned with that as well.
Well, it's just boring when you have somebody who goes through this huge adventure, trials and triumphs, and. and horrible things. They lose loved ones, friends, what have you. And there's, at the end of the day, they're the same guy they were, 2 weeks ago when this whole thing started.
Right. It's like, really? That didn't have any effect on you? Okay. You must be dead inside.
Yeah. I can go to a movie and be changed by it.
Right. Right.
But these people, they're killing, and there are people who are trying to shoot them, and they're jumping out of airships, and, you know, depending on what setting it is, and they take it all in stride, and then they get home and they're like, well, now I can finally go watch what I had on TiVo. And that's all it was. It was just another day at the office to them. Let's have some Aboleth questions. That'll be fun. Okay. What are primeval aboleths? Are we going to see any of those in another DDI thing? Primeval aboleths? They're more abolithy than normal ones?
The primeval aboleths are basically the ones that first came over from the Far Realm, and they're kind of like first generation, and then they were petrified in Xifu, and if there's any other places where they may exist. So they kind of have more of a connection to the tap, as it were. They're more aberrant than even as aberrant as the other aboleths are. But, you know, they've existed through several generations, and they've become more acclimated to the world and more, you know, attuned. You know, their goals are more within the world itself, whereas the primeval aboleths from Xifu really only really care about the goals that they had when they first came into the world, which are different and are kind of more revealed in Key of Stars. What the entire abolethic sovereignty is has a goal much different than, like, ruling, for instance. So, and that becomes more clear in the Key of Stars what that is.
Oh, good. You were going on about all this stuff. I'm going, I didn't get any of that.
Right. You know, for basically all you see is that these are monsters and they're scary and they're trying to kill us. Okay.
Well, now you'll have to point everybody who reads the book to this episode.
That's true.
So they can hear that's what the aboleths are really all about.
That they're scary monsters?
that they have an ulterior motive.
Yes. Well, if they read the third book, they'll know what that ulterior motive is.
No, you should just point them to this episode.
Oh, well, I will be pointing people to this episode. I'll be like, hey, look, I was interviewed on the Tome Show.
In fact,
you could put that in the foreword.
I think a section of the third book should just be, and if you want this explained, go to thetomeshow.com.
Get the text. Yeah. It's a weird spatial warp, and suddenly
your editor will love that.
Yes, I'm sure that will survive.
It'll be the first paper novel to include hypertext links. Yeah. Well, it has to be asked because you're sort of the aberrant guy. Have you read anything by Lovecraft? Any of his Cthulhu works?
Oh yes, of course. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Lovecraft and most of his works.
Okay.
And definitely, you know, very much a very strong contributor, influencer, you know, to the Far Realm itself. I mean, the Far Realm is Lovecraftian.
Oh, now I lost it. Here it is. Okay. All right. The first two books both follow sort of almost the same formula. Everybody starts off sort of separate, and then they're working towards kind of similar goals. And then somewhere around the middle, they all kind of meet up. Mm-hmm. And then in a terrible, horrible place, Xifu, the submerged Katoa Temple.
Right.
And then Raiden gets mad at Japheth.
yes.
But then monsters try to kill them. Bad things happen. Twist on the last page.
Yeah.
Was that intentional that they follow the same formula, or did you just happen to do that? And what does that hold for the third book?
I didn't actually expect them to split up again. I figured they would stay together, but the twist in the last part of the first book just made it so that it happened again. So there was a disintegration of the cohesion of the group, and they kind of had to each go their own way for a little bit to kind of accomplish the goals they thought were the most important, whether they were, you know, save the world or something a little more selfish. And what does that promise for the third book?
The twist at the end. Is it going to be like?
Everyone who is alive starts off together at the beginning of the third book.
Oh, that's good. Okay, I'm just hoping that the third book doesn't end with, you know, we won. Oh nope, Cthulhu's here. We won. We stopped Cthulhu. Oh, tentacle.
Yeah. What's that? Did you hear that? The end.
Yeah. This one's sort of game related. I don't know if you're allowed to answer or not. Do you think we'll ever see rules for things like the Lord of Bats, sort of almost domains for warlocks?
You mean specific creatures? I don't know.
Yeah, like individual archfey.
I think the Vestige Pact is probably more that route. I don't think I doubt we would see, you know, never say never, but it's, who knows? I guess you never know. It's an interesting question.
You can always submit the idea over it for a dragon article.
Maybe you should. Some sort of interesting thing. How a particular archfey might have a particular signature power if you choose that person or signature effect. Yeah, that's a very interesting idea.
All right. Let's see here. You're one of the few authors who, for D&D, who writes both the game supplements and the novels. Does that make the novels more difficult? Does that make you feel more like you should hew closer to what the class is supposed to can do?
I think it gives me the tools to be able to know what the general abilities of the characters would be, but it also allows me to, you know, to play within that general range. So I don't feel beholden to say this is the monk class and this character will do exactly that and will use this power. I just feel, since I have that knowledge, it gives me, you know, great inspiration and great ability to play within it. But yeah, I don't think it makes me hew closer. If anything, it just gives me greater freedom and confidence that I know where I can take a character without, you know, making it break the game, you know, and say someone wouldn't read it and go, oh, okay, there's no way this character could do that. Since I'm familiar with the game system, I know not to write in a way that would for someone who's a reader of the game material to know that could never happen. But I also am very cognizant that a lot of people who read these novels are not gamers, and I need to write in a fashion that they doesn't make them say, wow, this seems kind of very formulaic and mechanical. So I have to write within both those parameters.
All right, that makes sense. It just always bothered me when somebody was writing about a character and they did something that was completely against the game rules for them to do.
Right.
They're like, oh, the fighter picks up something and, you know, the fighter can suddenly throw unusually high level magic.
You know, that bothers me too. But I think that just breaks you out of. Yeah, I agree. I agree with you. And it shouldn't be that way, really. I mean, it's in the shared world books, the authors have a duty to you know, fall within the realm of the world, and that includes what characters can generally do if what they fall within a particular theme. And a fighting kind of character, you know, might have some underlying power, but that's probably, you know, part of one of the sub themes of the book, right? It's not suddenly, oh, good, I found a wand and I can use it in this fight. There's interesting ways to handle that kind of story development, and maybe not so good ways of handling it.
I don't have any specifically wrap up type questions, Jeff. You?
I think I've had my questions more or less answered. I'm good. In that case, we'll just thank Bruce for being on the show.
Well, I really appreciate you guys taking the time to first review the books and second to let me talk to you and answer your questions, because I enjoy talking about it.
Well, that's episode 118. I want to thank Will Wong for the review and Bruce Cordell for being available for the interview. You can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums, review the show on iTunes, or tell folks about it. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets a part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned on the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. And now, it's time to get the Cthulhoid appendages of the Abilethic Sovereignty off of me and go take a shower. This has been episode 118, Abilethic Sovereignty of
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.